Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power, which is going to today take us into a realm of, shall we call it science fiction? Maybe, maybe not. When you look at all the technology that has evolved within just a very, very short period of time, and the changes it's brought into our lifestyle, the thoughts and concerns and different projections of how technology is going to change our life, well, they're out there by the gazillion. Everybody has their own opinion. But my guest today, Rosalind Byrne, she has taken it to a different level. And her book, Waiting in the Silence, which is a fictitious book, however, it's got a lot in it that gives one pause for thought about how do we really want this world of technology that we're evolving into, where do we really want it to go? Rosalind, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Rosalind, this book, when I started, and I don't do a lot of reviews on a fictitious material, but I really found your book so interesting. Give us a little bit of your background. Why is it that the sci-fi technological arena was one that you decided you were going to tackle?
Well, as odd as it may sound, it was not a conscious decision. I had been, and still do, teach in an engineering school, and I had been in the midst of a five-year research project that involved interviewing 35 scientists around the United States whose work takes place at the nanoscale, which is at the scale of a billionth of a meter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working on a book project, and I fell asleep in a hotel room one night after interviewing some scientists in New York, and I woke up in the middle of the night and started writing. The result is Waiting in the Silence. It was not a decision to write science fiction. More, I think what happened was some part of my subconscious found that that was the only way to explore some of what I was learning that I didn't know what to do with outside of a fictional setting. It just flowed. It just worked. It's a way to separate from what's actually happening, but use the moral imagination to understand it and feel your way through it.
Many years ago, and I'm trying to remember, I think there's an old movie that was done by Charlie Chaplin, and it had to do with technology. And this is way, way, way back. And I vaguely recall something that I remember seeing on a television show, this man that was known for his whimsical walk and the way he did things. And I think I've got the right movie, but he's talking about how machines, in the movie, there was a projection. I think he did this way back in the 1920s. I mean, I could have the date wrong. Maybe one of my listeners can illuminate me on this. But I really think it's fascinating how H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, H.G. Wells talked about aliens from outer space. And you think of what we're going on through today. The Charlie Chaplin movie about technology replacing people. The Jules Verne about exploring under the sea. All of these things, in so much of it has evolved. We then have Star Trek. We have Battlestar Galactica, all kinds of programs that have evolved through the years. And when I went through yours, I went, wow, you're really moving forward into something that most people really don't have a clue about, and that is this nanotechnology. And this story about this environment on the East Coast, why is it you picked Martha's Vineyard in that area, Nantucket?
Well, I'm familiar with that part of the world. I grew up in New England. I was a lifeguard on Hyannis. I used to look at my beach, from my beach across, and point and tell people, no, that's Nantucket over there. And I actually honeymooned on Nantucket. So it's familiar terrain. But the other reason why I chose Nantucket as the focal point of the book is it's one of the most pristine, well-preserved, historically well-preserved, naturally exquisite environments that I've ever experienced. I've traveled all over the world. And Nantucket really, they've taken a lot of effort to preserve the history of the architecture, but the natural environment is really, really pristine and beautiful. And so I thought, what better place, one, to anchor an historic foundation of the story, but two, to talk about the what climate change might mean. And so to take some place that's so beautiful and sort of really, I hate to say, destroy it because of our hubris, because of our behavior. So it's more heartbreaking to me to take a place like that and, sort of unravel it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a poem by Lord Alfred Tennyson right at the very beginning of your book. It says, "Oh, breaking heart that will not break, Oriana. Oh, pale, pale face, so sweet and meek, Oriana. Thou smilest, but thou dost not speak. And then the tears run down my cheek, Oriana. What wantest thou? Whom dost thou seek, Oriana? I cry aloud, none hear my cries, Oriana. Thou comest atween me and the skies, Oriana. I feel the tears of blood arise up from my heart into my eyes, Oriana. Within thy heart my arrow lies, Oriana. O cursed hand, O cursed blow, Oriana, O happy thou liest low, Oriana. All night the silence seems to flow beside me in my utter war, Oriana. A weary, weary way I go, Oriana." It's from the ballad of Oriana. How is it that this touched you so deeply that you put this poem in the front of your book?
And interesting, Donna, as you read it, I feel very emotional hearing the meaning behind it, the way you express those words. Well, the ballad itself is more symbolic rather than literal, because that involved an accidental death of someone he loved. But she, in the book, Oriana herself, represents so much of what is at stake for us as we evolve and change our relationship with our bodies and with matter and with the earth through technology. And so with the battle, and the accidental death, it's like what do we want? What do we intend? What do we need to do to take good care of what's most precious to us, of Oriana's representation of fertility, of life, of the human body in its fullness, of the freedom and independence that she represents from our technological entanglements. How far do we want to go? And, with Lord Tennyson's battle, it was too late. It was done. It was over. Mm-hmm. He couldn't go back. And so he's weeping tears of blood. And so, the book sets it up so that, it's almost too late. We need to ask really deep questions of ourselves and each other about what we mean to do as we evolve with our technologies.
Well, the story begins in the prologue about what's called Vishnu, V-I-S-H-N-E-W. Now, this is an abbreviation for the Virtual Information System for Human Noetic Evolution and Welfare. Now, that is a mouthful. So Vishnu is a nice abbreviation, easy for people to immediately make a connection with. And, of course, there is an East Indian god, Vishnu. It's spelled differently, but the pronunciation is the same. And I thought it was an interesting correlation that you created this. However, what you also talk about is a global circuitry, and I'm quoting from your book, of ubiquitous nanosystems able to garner its power and knowledge from the hundreds of thousands of satellites that orbit close to the Earth's atmosphere. And there is this group of individuals that create this system, and there are seven localities on the planet in your book, It is the Scottish Isles, Patagonia, Iceland, Yemen, Sri Lanka, and the Monkey Bay region of Malawi, and then Nantucket, where there are these pockets where Vishnu, the virtual information system for human noetic evolution and welfare, has begun. And this is where the body, the essence of your story opens up to. And as you presented the poem in the beginning about Oriana, well, here she is. And she's in Nantucket. Now, I was so intrigued with the way you presented information. We're hearing today how, I just watched a video in the past 3 days about a doctor that is talking about a tiny little chip that is not even, it's like the size of the point of the head of a pen, that contains all kinds of sensory capacity that it can go through your, it's not going to cause any harm to the body, but it will read the body's blood system so that a doctor with a handheld unit can get a readout on your blood pressure, on what's happening in your blood system. And I'm watching this incredible medical advancement on one hand, but yet at the same time, I feel it's a stringent invasion of privacy. And just yesterday, I heard on the radio people saying, well, for this kind of capability, and it was relating to something else, but again, it had to do with technology, I'm willing to sacrifice my privacy for the security of having something here taking place. Man, your book addresses this big time.
That's exactly what I'm trying to do, among other things. And partly because I had asked my students a number of years ago, why, if they were upset about certain kinds of things going on in the world or in our country, why they were so placid and accepting, why it was so different in the 60s or 70s when people would sort of get out there and demonstrate. And they said, well, we won't do that because there are cameras everywhere, and we don't want to be seen by a potential employee who might not want to hire us if they see us demonstrating.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, oh, my goodness. And they said, and yet, are you upset about the cameras? And they said, no, that keeps us safe. So it's sort of a paradox, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Our behaviors are changing because we are no longer in a world where we can have privacy, and yet we want this sense of security. Now, is it a more dangerous world? Statistically, no. So where is that sense coming from that we need that kind of protection?
Mm-hmm.
Part of it comes because the technology is available. You see, part of what happens is we create technologies that express our needs, our desires, our fantasies, and then we adapt to them and it changes us. And so it's like cycle of cause and effect. We change, we create technologies, the technologies change us, we create new technologies, we change and adapt to them, and then we keep going. And so the concept of privacy probably won't even be in our language 100 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really go anywhere without being picked up by a satellite. I can look at someone's rooftop or backyard or front yard, not quite in real time yet, but soon in real time, and watch their movements just from my computer top.
Mm-hmm. And that is something we're finding with vehicles. That is where the security agencies can keep track on people. That is something we are seeing evolving big time. We look at what's happened with Social Security. It was never supposed to be used as an identification factor, but it's demanded upon a child's birth. You've got to assign a number. You have to do this. You have to do that. You have to do the other. And it's keeping track of things. So part of this story about Oriana is basically a projection. It could happen in 50 years. It could happen in 75 years. It could happen in 100 years. But she is born into this environment, so she doesn't know any different. This is what she knows. This is something that's just a part of her life. She doesn't question it. Why would she? There's no need to question. And she's here in Nantucket, and her dad is a man that has walked his own walk to the best of his capability. And he is severely punished for this. And, of course, as a child, she doesn't understand it. But she's out walking around, and you talk about a warming cream made for protecting extremities. And I thought, now this is interesting, because she's outside. It's very, very cold. But she meets someone that is not using something that, for her, is everyday life. And it brings to mind a movie put out, but was written by Bill Nolan, whom I know quite well. And Bill is a phenomenal writer, and he's highly recognized around the world for his science fiction, and then he got into horror stuff. But he did a book called Logan's Run, which they made into a movie, and that was done years and years and years ago. I don't know if it came out in the 50s or the 60s, something like that. But it was amazing the perception he had and his story. I thought, here he was. He's an older man now. He wrote this so many years ago because he could see certain patterns. And I thought, here you are in today's world, the 21st century, and you are writing about things as you are perceiving them. And I'm thinking, this is really intriguing because she's touched by this stranger, and alarm sensors would go off. And I go, holy Moses, look at what we're doing today. People are so paranoid about their children, about, oh my goodness, they could be kidnapped, something could happen. And here is this community where they have alarm sensors. People have to follow a certain patterning. If they don't, the alarms go off. This must have really been something when you were writing this, when you were getting this download of storyline, alarm systems that go off. What was so intriguing about this for you when you were putting this together?
You know, as you're speaking, there was a couple of things come to mind. One, what we know about science fiction is that most of it actually is accurate. The only thing that tends to go wrong is the prediction of when it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talked about this tiny, tiny, tiny device that will go inside the body, and then a handheld device will be able to read what it picks up from the bloodstream, et cetera, that just goes right back to Star Trek and the doctor on Star Trek that would just scan a body. Remember?
Right.
Yeah. So it's really just about when these things will come forward. And as long as it's scientifically plausible, you know, meeting physical laws, so that it's not fantasy, it's actually science fiction, it's really just a matter of time. I think one of the devices that's been on my mind for the last decade are the GPS chips that now people are putting inside their pets, so that if the dog or cat is lost, they can just use the radio frequency to pick up their location.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that it's just a matter of time before we do that with our newborn babies. People talk about having them implanted in the heels of the foot, you know, there's all that tissue, so that we don't have to be afraid of losing our children. In fact, we don't have a problem with kidnapping. We had more of a problem with kidnapping back in the 50s with, you know,
mm-hmm.
Lindbergh family and all that than we do now. And so, you know, there's really not a rational reason for it. It's more sometimes we do it because we can, because it's possible, and because it gives us a feeling of security. But these fears, some of them seem so irrational, but we're here now and we're doing it without questioning it.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that our cell phones all have these chips inside of them, and most of us are required to, I don't think, my understanding is that you can no longer buy a cell phone without one of these chips. Which means that as long as we're carrying our phone, our location can be picked up.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not questioning it because of the convenience of the phone, and the gadgets are really cool, and we can download apps, and it's a lot of fun, and it makes life simpler because you can, you know, get a map in your car, but what's inside that little black box that erodes our sense of privacy is not something we're conscious of. So as I'm writing, I'm trying to bring into consciousness the things that we don't question, so mm-hmm. that we can then question them and ask, is this what we want?
One of the components that you bring out, you talk about a snug-fitting head covering embedded with magnetic detection coils and tiny diodes connecting with the user's brain. While one is under the hood, remote viewing of the island is possible, including the inside of all public buildings as well as the homes of its inhabitants. It provides an entirely personalized education and customized user-prompted entertainment. The hood is the only way to travel, but Oriana has one, and she's been disconnected, and that was because of her father. So nobody can connect her. And this is something that is part of the book. How is it that we can disconnect so that we are not traceable, so that there is that sense of having the freedom of choice of being someplace and not so having someone dictate to you, sorry, you're not to go to the mall, or you're not to do this, you're not to do that, you're not to do the other. And I can just see in my head how families would say, oh, that would be terrific if I had my kid had a hoodie where I figured out where they were all the time. And I think about this and I go, my goodness, this is something that if you want to control a population, this is what you do. You mm-hmm. want to know where everyone is at all times. If someone is, let's see, who was the guy that wrote 1982, where there were televisions?
George Orwell.
George Orwell. Thank you very much. His name just wasn't coming to me quickly. He wrote about TVs that were in rooms and how everybody's actions were seen. Absolutely no privacy whatsoever. And in your book, Oriana is aware that without the hood, and she can go to certain places in Nantucket where there aren't any embedded cameras or sensors, and she delights in that. Because no one's going to know. And there's this young man that she comes to. And I was fascinated with how you brought the Quakers into this. And I thought, what an interesting choice of an organization, a grouping of people that have always had this phenomenal philosophy, as far as I'm concerned, for anybody and everybody to have the right of choice and the right of freedom. And I thought, wow, this gal's really put together a number of components of history, yet you have been involved and are involved even to this day in the world of technology. And this is what your book, Waiting in the Silence, is all about. And this is just the first book. You've got a sequel coming out, haven't you?
I'm working on it, yes. I'm waiting for the deeper inspiration to unfold, but the sequel takes place on Martha's Vineyard.
And I also was fascinated with the fact that Oriana has no clue about her genetic origin, because in her world, there's no definitive description of that. And I'm just going, wow, you have really touched a nerve, as far as I'm concerned, a nerve of reality that many, when they're reading this, they might say, you know, this is too close to the truth. This is scary. Is this really what I want in a reality for my children or my grandchildren to live in?
Yeah, I have students who were really angry with me about this book.
Why were they angry?
I think that anger is often a response of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, I think it takes a certain kind of maturity to read this book. And I think some of them may have been not yet exposed enough to the world to handle some of what comes up in the book.
What I think also, because you touch on things, we all know about the laboratory babies. We don't like to talk about them very much, but that is a fact. And embryos, there's been big discussion about that. But in your book, you talk about the genetic alteration, and that's already been brought up in some movies about people wanting certain aspects for their children. I mean, they've been trying to work on this for I don't know how many generations. There are labs, I know, in California and in other parts of the country and even in the world where they will take semen from brilliant geniuses where someone can pay for a certain amount of money being impregnated with that. Now, that sounds rather coarse and crude, and people listening to it might say, oh, my goodness, this is the last thing I expected to hear on Donna's show. But these are things that go on. This has been happening for a long time. It's just pushed under the rug. And you bring up how wombs are grown in a molecular foundry used for babies who grow outside of their mothers. And there is an initiation period for the females. Now, again, these are little pockets because this Vishnu organization and grouping, they are wanting to do something on a bigger scale, but they've got these little pockets that they've been able to get into, and they're not interfered with because the environments they're in literally have become depleted. They just don't have very much life in them. But the people that are within them, if you get enough generational time, they become complacent. They just say, oh, this is comfortable. I don't want to have to worry about it. And it's a real interesting patterning that you're showing. So you're showing a part of the psyche of the human being that I think is really intriguing. And it doesn't surprise me your students were upset.
Yeah, many of them were. So about the wombs being grown in the foundry, you know, everything in this book I base on research of current studies underway. So there are two labs that I know of, one at Cornell University here in the United States and one in Japan, where they're experimenting with exo-uterine gestation. And in one case, they were able to actually gestate the fetus of a mammal almost full term without being in its mother's body.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
this is real.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who's doing this research at Cornell is doing it because she believes that there are a lot of people who cannot carry their own children who would like an option. So it's another offering in the work of fertility, just like you talked about donor sperm being more expensive if it comes from people who are considered geniuses or go to places like Harvard, et cetera. We're already living with this. This is already part of our reality.
Mm-hmm.
The complacency, I think, comes because of comfort, exactly as you say. We like our gadgets. We like what they can do. Microwaving food makes life simpler and things are faster and more efficient. And so what I'm concerned about is that because we're comfortable and life is more efficient and we are living much, much, much longer than we ever were and we feel that maybe we're getting healthier, that we feel like we're on the right track. And perhaps we are, but I just don't know that we're fully conscious and therefore fully conscientious of our choices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you bring out in your story, there's this magnificent tree. And it is a tree that is considered in the off territory. And there is a young man, a socially maladjusted youth. This is how he has been proclaimed by the Vishnu organization. And Oriana and this socially maladjusted youth end up getting together, and for the first time in her life, she goes and she hugs a tree. And it's an experience that she's never had. This is not something she's had. So it deals with, I think, the cycles of life. It deals with the human perspective of what is your choice that you want to make? What do you want to do? Oriana's story is an amazing story. And for those of you that are listening, if you are intrigued with sci-fi, this book, Waiting in the Silence by Rosalind Byrne, is a book that is, yes, fictitious. But this is a woman that works in the environment of technology. She's teaching. She's in it. And you can go to her website, Rosalind Byrne, that's Rosalynberne, is the spelling of her last name, .com, and you'll find out about the other books that she has written. But this is a book that is really more about what's going on today and a potential possibility of how it actually can evolve in a way we would never have desired. So I think Waiting in the Silence, Rosalind, is a phenomenal read.
I'm glad you think so, Donna. It was an amazing experience to write it. It's as if it wrote through me from my subconscious, and I found myself awakened sometimes in the middle of the night because a character had something to tell me, and I'd have to get up and go write it down. I feel like at least it can help us to have conversations about what we're doing with our technologies, what we want, who we think we are, what it means to be living as human beings at this time in our bodies, what it means to be embodied.
And where do we want to put ourselves? What kind of quality of life do we really want? Do we want to become like a caretaken machine? Or do we want to really still live with the vibrancy of risk, the unknown, and the creativity that is naturally ours? I think Waiting in the Silence, Rosalind Byrne, you have done a phenomenal job with this. Thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you so much for your inquisitiveness and your wonderful insight regarding my book.
You're more than welcome. Check out our website, rosalindbyrne.com. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com. to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Do you have a product or service that you would like people to know about? Internet radio is a powerful medium that can assist you in reaching people who like to shop online and pass by electronic word of mouth information about you, your products, and or services. The Donna Sebo Show reaches around the world, and you can be part of that enterprising network. For more information, contact Vision Broadcasting via donna@delphiinternational.com
or call 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. I wanted to tell you, phone lines are open if you'd like to call in and chat with me. I'd be delighted to do that. 888-627-6008, by the way, if you would like a reading. I would be happy to do that for you as well. 888-627-6008. All I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then you're welcome to ask me about anything that is of interest to you, and I'll share with you my perceptions. How many of us have been, in the United States anyway, when we were in school and we were being taught history about Ponce de Leon and how he was looking for the Fountain of Youth in Florida? I really have to chuckle about how so much information is coming forward, dispelling age-old myths. In fact, I'm looking forward to having a guest on. I think it's next month that the person is scheduled. Well, we're going to be talking about Florida and its legend of the Fountain of Youth, but it goes back a long, long way. Well, it is a myth. It's not anything that really is true, but like many aspects of promotion and advertising, oh, yes, goes all the way back to 1511. People were doing it then, and they're doing it just as much today. The myth grew in and of itself, of course. Florida was this tropical environment that just was lush with so many things. including supersized bugs. Believe me, I know. I met a few of them. And I'm just absolutely intrigued with some information that crossed my desk recently about Ponce de Leon. Now, he departed Puerto Rico in 1513 for the wonderful island of Bimini. Now, this was uncharted at this time. You can see the sailors of old in their small, tiny wooden ships that were going from point A to point B, trying to find out information and charting what, for them, was brand new territory. Eventually, he landed in Florida. He didn't arrive at Bimini. And, of course, he staked the claim for the Spanish crown. And he became a very significant figure in history, both for Spain as well as for us here in the United States. Now, scholars have maintained, and they lied, they maintained that Ponce de Leon was searching for the Fountain of Youth. Now, what is the Fountain of Youth? Well, you know, you can figure it out. You drink the water, you never grow old. Well, that isn't true. There are scholars today that say, this is a bunch of hooey. This isn't something that was real at all. It was a myth perpetuated because it gave the image for exploration and for colonization that was wanted, about an ideal place. He was not interested in finding the power of youth. That wasn't on his mind. It was politics and gold. Yes, that's what it was. Now, there was a lot of political activity going on. Sound familiar? Well, seems like times don't change all that much, even with generations that are a long time away from 1511. Ponce de Leon happened to be the governor of Puerto Rico, and he had to surrender it. And he had been the governor there from 1509. Now, the surrender occurred in 1511. Now, King Ferdinand offered him the island of Bimini, and he expected that the explorer was going to be able to pull the money together for the expedition and find it. That's right. He said, okay, dude, I'm going to give you this island over here, but, you know, you're going to have to pay for it. Gee, that sounds so modern. Anyway, there is a fellow by the name of J. Michael Francis. He's a historian at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg, Florida. And he spent a long time studying the history of the Spanish colonies. And he said, with all of the contracts and other official correspondence with the crown that has been maintained, not one thing is mentioned about the Fountain of Youth. It didn't become connected with the Fountain of Youth legend until a long time after his death. And do you know how it came about? You're not going to find this. You might find this a surprise. It was someone that disliked him intensely. That's right. There was a Spanish court chronicler that wanted to discredit him. Gonzalo Fernandez de Oviedo y Valletes. Yes, he didn't like Ponce de Leon. So he said, I'm going to fix you. Court politics at the basis of it. Mr. Gonzalo, he wanted Columbus to be really successful. And so he was the one that managed to push Ponce de Leon out of Puerto Rico. So all of this story started, this myth started because somebody didn't like somebody else. Facts? There aren't any to support the myth. So the romance of the myth has taken off and obviously, even to this day, is used in promotional advertising. It's magical. And of course, in the 50s and the 60s, it really reached all-time high. And it helped the development of the state of Florida big time. And it continues to capitalize on this legend. There is a stone well at St. Augustine's Fountain of Youth Archaeological Park. People go to, thousands and thousands and thousands of people go to this to get a drink out of the proposed Fountain of Youth. And whether it's real or not, what fun But this is a little bit of history that I didn't know anything about. Did you? Well, I appreciate those that are willing to do the homework and the research because it sure does make a difference. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. 888-627-6008 if you'd like to call in. Tomorrow, and I know we've got a caller here. Quickly before I go to the caller, I'm going to say tomorrow we're going to be talking with Linda Graham. We're going to be talking about her wonderful book, Bouncing Back. So many of us have gone through challenges. This has been, in the United States, a very rough period. Actually, it started before 2008, and it's just seemingly compounding. But what we want to do is know that we're resourceful and we can make changes. How do we take charge of who we are and not depend on some external source in the way that we are often indoctrinated to do? What do we do? How do we do it? Well, we'll find out tomorrow. Linda Graham. This is Donna Siebel. We're going to go to our caller today. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
Hi there. This is M calling from Sacramento.
From Sacramento. Welcome to the show. I'm so delighted you called in. Okay, Em, the first thing that I am looking at with you is the word discipline. Now, you're very familiar with this, but you have felt a little bit fenced in by your circumstances. Now, the image I'm getting in my mind is like a little white picket fence. It comes up to about your knees. You're freestanding behind it. There's nothing tying your hands down or tying you down, but this little white picket fence is around you. And I think the reason that this symbology is being shown to me is that you're wanting security. You are in a very decisive year here. You are going to find yourself making a number of decisions prior to September the 9th that involve a bit of risk. So this little white picket fence, which really isn't going to keep anything out, it gives you a sense of security. It's sort of like having maybe $6,000, $10,000 in the bank, knowing if you need it, it's there. Well, I understand that, but you need to know. It's going to be very easy for you to either pull up this little white picket fence or step right over it. You don't need to be afraid. You have nothing to be afraid of here. But discipline is the key. You need to be able to establish your focus. And I am looking at 1, 2, 3, 4 different components that at this time you're very involved with. One of them is money, and one of the aspects is dealing with wellness. Another one is dealing with personal relationships. So this is sort of basic stuff, but it's your own individual experience. And what I want you to know is you have been put into this environment because it's time to pull up the loose ends. It's time to anchor them down, seal them up, and get past what I feel is your concerns about security. So take care of your loose ends right now. You're fine. There's no harm. There is no heavy-duty negative that I'm looking at here. But you have to prove it to yourself, and that's what you're going through right now. You're proving to yourself, number one, that you have the tenacity, the perseverance, and the action, the discipline, the action, to take care of what needs to be taken care of. Number two, you will be able to move forward this year as you desire to move forward because of the disciplined action. And number three, don't push, don't shove, go with the flow. But more than that, keep your eyes and your entire sensory system open for clues of information, connections with people that you may want to utilize in the last quarter of the year to prepare you for 2014. So you're in the right place. Really, there's nothing wrong with your life. You are merely going through this cycle that will finalize by the first part of September, by the 9th of September, and you are establishing a foundation that's going to take you forth into 2014. So you're okay. Just remember, you need to have the disciplined action to take care of what needs to be taken care of, and it's that simple. Do you have a question for me?
Wow. Thank you for that.
Now, does that help you? Does that help you?
It helps a lot because I actually know that there's something that's actually supporting me in a very real way than I've ever felt before. So I feel that. But I think what you might have been picking up on, because it's actually a call about love life, is just the remnants of just getting out of a relationship that kind of blindsided me in a way. And I'm trying to move forward, and I think I am processing a lot of that pain and the grief from moving through that.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess my question would be, I guess it's a two-parter, is A, is that relationship complete? And B, I am looking for someone new now because I feel like I've done so much work on myself that I'm ready for something better.
All right. We have to take a break here for a moment. Will you stay with me, Em, and then I'll get right back to you. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be coming back with Em, and if you want to give me a call, 888-627-6008. We're taking a break. We'll be right back.
If you are an author and would like to be a guest on the Donna Sebo Show, please send a review copy of your publication along with a press release to the Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. Allow 6 to 8 weeks for your material to be reviewed. Again, the address to send your material to is The Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. Have you ever had a paranormal experience, such as seeing a ghost, having precognitive dreams, out-of-body experiences, or other happenings? If so, Donna would like to hear from you. She's putting together a book of 100 stories from people who would like to tell their story. If you'd like to submit yours, send an email to donna@delphiinternational.com. Again, send your story to donna@delphiinternational.com. Be sure to include your contact information as well. Thank you.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. 888-627-6008 is the number to call into. And we're talking with Em in Sacramento, California. Em, you had a question of two parts. One, you wanted to know if the relationship was finished, and two, you wanted to know about a future relationship. Number one, let me give you a little information here. The relationship that you have been in was a teaching process. You are coming out of what I call indoctrinated belief systems. You are examining them, and this is what we call maturation. You are going through a process. There's no guilt here, and you do not even need to be concerned that this relationship has ended. It should have ended months ago. However, you are a person that wants to make sure that you do everything that you can until you realize, my goodness, it just isn't gonna cut it. I can't deny the facts that are in front of me. Now, again, this is a part of your maturation as a woman. Also, you recognized in this relationship that you were compromising too much. And also, it was an awareness on the part of the person that you were with. They were doing the same thing. So you both basically were teaching each other what you don't want. And this is important. So the healing aspect of this is already evolving. And yes, it's finished. However, you're saying you're ready for someone else. No, you're not. Because you have not yet gotten to a point of really actualizing and recognizing the truth of who you are and what is most meaningful to you. Now, that may not be something that you want to hear at this moment, but you need to get to a point, and I'm not saying this to be critical of you, dear, not at all, because all of us go through these lessons in one form or another. It's part of the experience in life. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just what we have to evolve through. And so this is where you are at this point. You still are dealing with a fear of being alone. And what you are going to come into an understanding of is that you need to be so comfortable in your own skin that whether you have someone in your space or you don't have one in your space, you are in harmony with your life. And that's what you're evolving through. Now, I am looking at a person that's going to be coming into your space, maybe give it about year and a half. And when you cross paths, there is going to be a harmonic that is going to allow you to come in contact with each other again. But you need to make it okay that you finalize this clarity that you are achieving. You must allow this to fill itself and empty itself out so that you have some space for understanding really more about who you are. It's okay to have the emptiness. It is okay to be able to have clarity. And this is where you are right now. Bringing someone into your space, there's plenty of people that would be happy to pop themselves in, but all you're going to do is have more of the same because you still haven't gotten through this evolutionary process of your own self. So relax about this.
I don't think it's a year and a half, though. Because I just don't feel that in myself.
Well,
I hear you.
Okay, I want you to understand what I'm saying, though. You're evolving into a whole new level of yourself. You cannot see this evolution in its completeness because it hasn't finished itself yet.
Yes.
So I want you to relax. I want you to enjoy being who you are. I want you to be aware of whatever grief you are feeling, because it is. It is something, when you go through this separation, there's all kinds of emotions of failure and what if I did this better, or I didn't do that, or I'm angry, I'm all this. It's okay. Look at that, but realize that's not it. You are growing up into a woman that is needing to recognize really who she is, and this takes some time. And so you don't want to keep putting on bandages. That's all that anything that would come in at this time would be. So allow yourself to go through the healing process. Allow yourself to discover more of who you are. And I think you're going to have a very, very rich life. But take time, breathe. Don't worry about bringing someone else into your space. You don't need that at this time.
Okay.
And I want to thank you for calling in. You have a wonderful, wonderful day. This is Donna Sebo. If you'd like to give me a buzz, 888-627-6008. Write the number down, because we're not going to have time to take your call at this moment. And don't forget, tomorrow we're going to be talking with Linda Graham, Bouncing Back. That is something that is very important. Three meals a day. How did we ever come up with that kind of patterning? Have you ever wondered about that? Now you may say, Donna, that's one of the most nonsensical things I've ever heard. Well, we all have patternings in our lives that we go through. Breakfast, lunch, dinner. Well, do you know, in the Middle Ages, two meals a day was standard. Well, people didn't have a heck of a lot of food available. They also didn't have 7-Elevens and grocery stores on just about every corner. But also, they had a tradition of fasting. And eventually, that was modified. But let's face it, most of the people were starving to death. They didn't have food readily available like we do today. So those that were, at that time, in the medieval ages, the young, the sick, and the very old were permitted a third meal. What was the third meal? It was the morning meal, breakfast, for health reasons. Well, everybody liked it, right? Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And by the 17th century, it became very normal, and all levels of society were practicing it. And you know what? They've done research on this, and they found that morning, noon, and evening meals are really in balance with the way the body works. Now, if you're a night person, it might be a different patterning, but the body functions very, very well when you have this nutritional patterning of nourishing the body. Now, so many times the number three has been given a specific significance, but you know what? There's also a patterning that has evolved in, I would say, more the 20th century, of having like six small meals a day. We'll stick with the three. But snacking is something that a lot of people have ended up adopting. This is Donna Seabold. I'm so delighted that you were able to share this time with me today, and I invite you to join me again. We've got some wonderful guests coming up next month, and all of that listing and information will be posted on BBS. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Seabold. You have a magnificent day or evening wherever you may be on this wonderful planet of ours, and join me again tomorrow. Well, we've always got good things to share right here on The Donna Seabold Show. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Seabold Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.